Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Edward O'Connor. I'm the attorney for the Eclipse Group with the appellants. I would just start off by saying that the contract in question is a classic joint and several agreement. There is nothing in this agreement on the four corners which in any way indicates that there is separate independent portion of the liabilities for the two payors. The contract makes it clear that the two payors are responsible for making separate payments to Eclipse and to Lobin, totaling a certain amount of money. There's nothing in there which says, however, Target is only responsible for X percent and Kmart is only responsible for Y percent. It does say that they can pay this thing by terms of one check.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Okay, given that Target was liable for roughly two-thirds of the unpaid legal fees identified in the complaint, why was it unreasonable for the district court to have concluded that the parties intended for Target and Kmart to pay a corresponding portion of the settlement amount?
Well, there's two responses. The first is, it doesn't matter whether it was reasonable if that was their intent. It's not specified in the agreement, and that's what controls. The second thing is, this complaint...
Right, the agreement doesn't say joint and several, and it doesn't say two-thirds and one-third. So, in my view, thank you for both of you for an agreement that's a hot mess. And so, what both of you want it to say, it doesn't say. So, then my understanding is... it's hard for me to say that it wouldn't be ambiguous, or in California anyway, you can look at parole evidence anyway, right?
Well, you can look at it to resolve an ambiguity. You can't look at it to change the terms or add anything to the contract, which isn't there.
Well, if
help
I both
me, help me on something there. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge Kleinfeld.
Help me on something there. I had trouble seeing why the parole evidence mattered. It didn't look as though the parole evidence was clarifying an ambiguity. It looked as though whatever was the situation before the parole evidence still was the situation after. What does it matter?
I don't think it does. I mean, that was part of our position. The parole evidence was that the Target had taken a position that it was only responsible for a certain percentage of the bills, and I didn't answer that part of your question. I will in a second. But that was Target said that in negotiations. Never did we agree to that. There's nothing in the parole evidence rules that indicates there was a meeting of the minds on any separate proportionate liability on behalf of Target versus the other. So, it in our opinion, that added nothing.
Well, why didn't you have it joint and several then? You didn't say that either. I got two lawyers here, and I'm going to assume that you know, we say what we mean, and neither of you said what you're asking us to mean right now.
Because the law is critical, and we decided the California statute, but you don't even need that. It's just basic contracts. If there's a contract that says A and B owe a C, $500,000, that's a joint and several liability. They don't have to use the words joint and several liability. It just says A and B O C. That's joint and several. And that's what we have here. If you look at paragraph 3, that's exactly what it says at the very beginning. It says, in consideration, et cetera, Target and Kmart agreed to cause to be paid a collective sum of $425 distributed between Eclipse and Lobin as described below. It doesn't say proportionately. It says these two together will cause that to be paid.
Mr. O'Connor, I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Judge Kleinfeld, we're getting a lot of feedback on the papers. Sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you could just slow down, because I was having difficulty hearing you, too.
Sure. When
you say the parole evidence, the extrinsic evidence wouldn't help at all, I guess I'm more in line with there, without it stating joint and several and contemplating a payment of a portion, to me there would seem to be ambiguity. I thought the parole evidence did tie invoices to specific amounts in separate cases that the two companies owed.
Well, that was the previous question by Judge Callahan. The complaints were not limited to a claims on an account. This was for work that was done in value. And our complaint was for far more than the invoices.
Right, but there was $140,000 that's about the third that Kmart isn't paying. And it seems that some of that in the parole evidence showed that Target didn't have anything to do with those cases. So why, you know, I guess I'm sort of channeling off of what Judge Higginson was saying. It seems like that 140,000, there is some evidence in the parole evidence that would indicate it was just Kmart. Although we're Kmart cases, not cases where Target and Kmart were liable together.
Right. Well, if that was the basis, like I said, the individual liability is based on quantum merit, is far more than the amount. So we didn't agree that they could apportion. And parole evidence is intended, but there's an ambiguity, to show the intent of the parties, not the intent of one of the parties. So the parole evidence that the court referenced and you're referencing, this was parole evidence submitted by Target to support its position. Never an indication that we agreed to it. So what controls is the writing. And that's the parole evidence rule. That once, and it's also in our contract, the integration clause, once they've written it, the discussions that went before are not relevant unless there is a clear ambiguity, which means what does this mean?
Okay, since it doesn't say joint liability, let's say it doesn't say joint liability. Just hypothetically, if we were to agree that with Target that the settlement agreement doesn't impose joint liability, but also determined that the amount of Target's liability under the agreement was uncertain. So what does that do? It blows up the whole thing? Is that what it does? It just blows up the whole agreement because there was no meeting of the minds?
Sure. If that's the case, there's no contract. Nobody's contending there was no contract. So
okay, wait. Sorry. No, sorry. That's very – so you are not embracing the notion that lack of neutrality, the contract's a nullity.
Yeah, I am. If there was lack of mutuality, there would be no contract.
Where did you argue that to the district court?
I'm not sure.
Well, did you even argue it in your principal brief?
I'm pretty sure. Oh, yes, we did. Absolutely.
Well, could you, before you get up for rebuttal, if you could find the page in your principal brief and the record site to where you argued no mutuality, that would be very helpful to me. I thought it only came up in your reply brief in a footnote attempt to adopt Mr. Lobbin's argument.
Okay, well, I'll take a quick look on that when the other side is talking.
But, a little bit curious.
Yeah.
Did you ever try to mediate this case?
Yes, we did.
With our mediators?
Yes, we did.
All right. Well, I'm just curious, after we get through all of this oral argument, if I can't speak for my colleagues and we haven't conferenced on this, I can't speak on anything. But if both of you were sitting there, it strikes me as odd that, all right, Target's already paid quite a bit of money, and we're talking about $140,000. And even though I don't know how much each of you are spending on attorney's fees, and I think I looked at the contract before I came to court today, that whoever prevails then can have more attorney's fees. No one seems to be thinking like about business decisions here, and we've got two businesses going on. It just is curious to me that I bet the attorney's fees of both of you is more than $140,000 now, and it's going to be more than that after. And it just seems to me, after we all listen to all of this, we're going to ask hard questions of Mr. Lechinger as well. As far as that goes. So I'm just really curious about that.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, but the amount of money involved initially was quite small, and we were willing to go down on that.
Well, Kmart's in bankruptcy, and it's unsecured, right? So you're not going to get the money from Kmart.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. So
I know, but if you spend $500,000 and lose trying to get the money from Target, then you have to pay all the attorney fees too, right?
Well, that there's a question on that, and I don't want to go into that unless you want me to. But
no, but it you can't help but that, you know, there's kind of a, you can't help but notice all of that when you're looking at it. There's a real world side to this.
Well, that's true. The initial amount was a small amount. We didn't think there would be an issue. Target could afford that additional small amount. They left us with no choice, in my opinion, but to litigate this thing. We're doing this to collect this money on behalf of the people who worked on this case.
I've got a question that the clerks did not advise me of. If the clerk could just stop the clock for a second, I have a question. I am looking at Mr. lobbin here, his face here. I wasn't, is there some designation on, we didn't just, I generally discuss this before people start. It says that Mr. O'Connor, it says Mr. Lobbin, it says 2 minutes. Is that correct? Can the clerk come on for a sec?
That's correct.
Yes, that's what it says.
All right. Does that depend whether we even decide whether Mr. Lobbin is a party to this?
I did not prepare the day sheet. I'm just here today to assist, but I can ask about that.
Well, that, I mean, we're the ones that decided anyway, but I'm just curious on here that it's, because there's also before us, there was a motion to strike Mr. Lobbin's brief, I believe, because he didn't appeal from below. So maybe we can start the clock again. And maybe, Mr. O'Connor, you can address that.
Yes, Judge, we're starting.
How much time do you want me to put on the clock?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. So I'll let you know on that, because I think that the panel's got to is Mr. Lobbin a party?
Yes, I believe he is, Your Honor. He certainly was.
I can check right now.
He lost below, though. He didn't appeal, right? So what's his status to be a party here? Are you just ceding part of your oral argument to him, or what is the?
We could look at it that way. Yeah, or I can tell you what his argument is. I mean, basically, that he wasn't even involved in this conversation where he supposedly disagreement where Mr. Lessinger set forth his client's position. He wasn't even in that conversation. I don't see how he can be bound by it. I think other than that, he and I are pretty much in agreement on the substance of the arguments that I'm making.
Well, who's giving him 2 minutes then? You're giving him 2 minutes?
Yes.
Of your time?
Yes.
Okay, and you want 3 minutes on rebuttal?
Correct. Well, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. I thought we had 5 minutes on rebuttal, but...
you have 15 minutes total.
Right.
I'm just looking at this, and so...
That's right. So that would be 3 minutes rebuttal, yes.
All right, but when the clock started out, I guess for the courtroom clerk, did we put 15?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, but if Mr. Lobbin's taking 2, then you're down to, and you want 3 on rebuttal.
I'm down to 14 seconds.
You're down to 14. Is the math wrong here? They said there'd be no math here, but... Maybe I can talk to my colleagues here. Am I reading that? I'm sorry. I apologize. I usually discuss this previously or straighten this out before. That's why I've stopped the clock. But
I think you're right on. It's 14 seconds with Steve having 2 and then me having 3 for rebuttal. If we can do that.
Do my colleagues want to proceed that way?
Yep, I'm fine with it.
All right, so you're basically down. So you would have 3 minutes and 14 seconds for rebuttal at this point.
That's fine.
So do you want to stop right now and then give the 2 minutes to Mr. Lobbin?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So now I'll instruct the clerk to put 2 minutes on for Mr. Lobbin. He's not going to have any rebuttal time. He's got 2 minutes total. And Mr. O'Connor has... 3 minutes and 14 seconds left on rebuttal.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
I apologize. Thank you. All right, Mr. Lobbin, state your appearance and tell me why you get to talk to us we should strike your brief.
Stephen Lobbin here, SML Avocati PC is my firm. I'm a party to the case. We're aligned in the issues on this appeal with Eclipse Group. I didn't file a separate notice, but I am a party to the case and filed a brief, and I'll take the court's instruction as to whether I get to chime in. But I would like
to... We're giving you 2 minutes. Yeah, we're down.
I would like to make a couple points, and I appreciate your honor.
But your principal brief didn't come prior to the appellee's opportunity to respond.
Correct. It was a brief filed at the opportunity after the opening appeal brief was filed.
And you've brought up the rescission neutrality argument that I don't see in Eclipse's principal brief. So they've never had a chance to respond to that.
Understood, Your Honor. I did bring that up. You know, look, this is an issue of law. De novo review, the court's job here.
Help me on something, Mr. Lobin. Suppose that we were to reverse, would that benefit you, or does the judgment still stand as to you, even if we reverse as to Eclipse, because you did not file a notice of appeal?
Well, I get the technical point, and Your Honor, perhaps it was a mistake.
A little more than technical, possibly.
Well, I believe the contract is the contract. If correctly construed, it would inure to my benefit, I believe, or to my detriment if construed by this court. So, you know, separate appeal filing fee, perhaps, was why I didn't file. But Eclipse and I are totally aligned on the issue of this contract needs to be correctly construed. And as a practical matter, you know, this is, to Judge Callahan's point, this is a case of no good deed goes unpunished by a big corporation. This has been a 10-year journey just to get paid, okay? And so we believe that the equities compel some consideration. If there is parole evidence considered, consider the context of this case. It's not about contracts. It's not about breach of contract. It's about quantum merit. This case was about value for services rendered. So there is no separation between Target and Kmart. And there's no separation in the four corners of the agreement. There's one amount, $425,000, two debtors. That's the classic joint and several liability. Thank you.
Well, it seems like it's really easy to say. That's what lawyers do. And I got three of them here sitting in the room, right?
Thank you. I don't want to go over my time, yes, there are three lawyers. I was taught contracts by Professor McGovern at UCLA. It seems like a first-year issue that the four corners of the contract need to control. And
let me find out if my colleagues have any additional questions of you. Do either of you have any additional questions of Mr. Lobin?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Then we'll move to Mr. Letchinger. I may have botched that. I'm sorry.
No, actually, you did a very good job. So I appreciate that because it doesn't happen very often. And may it please the court, my name is John Letchinger and I represent Target. I think I'm going to...
Well, why don't you just ask really quickly, because I think one of my colleagues noted that Mr. Lobin, when he filed the brief, it didn't really give you a chance to say anything. But by the same token, I checked, and I don't think you ever asked for an opportunity to reply, did you?
We did not, Your Honor. We elected to file the motion to strike because, as Mr. Lobin just acknowledged, he didn't file a notice of appeal. We think the judgment is binding on him. But with respect to what he did file and with respect to Judge Higginson's question about rescission and when it was raised, I wanted to just make one point, if I could. Mr. Lobin accuses us of falsely asserting that the rescission issue was never raised before the lower court. And then he cites to leave a footnote in a motion an opposition brief he filed, and he points to ECF 254. Well, that is the absolute first time anything about the enforceability or rescission of his contract came up, and that was 4 months after the notice of appeal was filed. Mr. Lobin mentioned that ECF 254 is in opposition to our motion for fees well after the motion to enforce was decided, well after the motion to reconsider was decided, and well after the notice of appeal by Eclipse was filed. So,
Counsel?
Yes?
Counsel, I understand your point on that. Let me get you back to the main argument. I want to tell you what I'm thinking here so that you can respond to it. I start with California, with the California statute at Civil Code 1660, a promise made in the singular number but executed by several persons is presumed to be joint and several. Now, when I read a statute like that, I think that's not just an instruction to courts on how to read it. It's also the context, the background against which contracts are made. When lawyers draft a contract, they know what the law is regulating contracts. And then I look at what the settlement agreement says, and it says Target and Kmart agree to cause Eclipse and Lobin to be paid a collective sum of $425,000 to be distributed between Eclipse and Lobin as detailed in this agreement. Payment to Eclipse shall be in the amount of $232,918 and so forth. And it says that Eclipse and Lobin recognize that Target and Kmart will each pay a portion of the settlement proceeds, and Eclipse and Lobin may receive their payments in one or more check payments from Target and or Kmart. Now, when I put that together with the statutory presumption, I think the lawyers know perfectly well that the presumption is it's joint and several. They write a contract that says that it's mainly directed toward the total collective sum and how it should be distributed between Eclipse and Lobin. There's not a word in there about how it shall be distributed between Target and Kmart, even though the draftsmen all know that the presumption is it's joint and several. Where the contract expressly speaks to portions, it puts it in terms of showing that the money may not come in one check, it may come in two checks, which obviously means that it's going to come from, as the contract says, Target and or Kmart. Now, the virgule between and or, that's been troublesome to me in so many cases since the 1970s when I was in practice. It's inherently ambiguous. Whenever I see a virgule, I think, so is it and or is it or? In this context, with a statute saying that there's a presumption of joint and several, all I can figure is that the lawyers meant that it's none of Lobin's and Eclipse's business, department store, whatever it is, pays how much of the money. All they care about is how much Eclipse gets and how much Lobin's gets. And what that means is reverse. What am I missing there? That's my logic on it, my thinking. And you have to think that it's wrong because you want us to affirm. So explain to me what I'm misunderstanding.
Thank you, Your Honor. And respectfully, I think our position is right. Eclipse and Mr. Lobin pursued at the lower court this entire matter on reliance on Section 1431, which is a different presumption, and it's a stronger presumption. They argued it the entire way. We pointed out, and the district court agreed, that 1659 and 1660 applies. On the face of 1431, it specifically says, in the situation of one type of contracting situation, that you can only rebut it with certain language. Contrast and compare 1659 and 60. The interpretation by both a California court and a district court in California is that the presumption is extremely weak. It is the lowest form of evidence. And Judge San Martino...
Sure, it's a rebuttable presumption, but I can't see anything that rebuts it.
I'm going to do my best to try to convince you otherwise. The section you were reading, Judge Kleinfeld, I agree that part of it talks about the certain portions and or et cetera. The very first sentence of the last paragraph of Section 3 of what Judge San Martino found that I said had to be in the agreement, where it said Eclipse and Lobin recognize that Target and Kmart will each pay a portion. Okay, that was my obviously poor attempt to try to make sure it was very clear this was not joint and several. And
well, wait a minute, that clause doesn't stand alone. It's part of one sentence, and the sentence says recognize that each will pay a portion and Eclipse and Lobin may receive their payments in one or more checks, wire payments from Target and or Kmart. And the context, when you read the whole sentence, seems to be that Lobin and Eclipse should recognize it may not be one check, it may be two checks.
It may be two checks because in terms of, well, this part was logistics because Mr. Lobin joined in later and he insisted on being paid directly as opposed to it all being paid together because he didn't trust
Eclipse.
So that's why that language is in there, but I believe...
Well, I guess so. Your brief contends that Target insisted during negotiations that Target would pay two-thirds of the settlement amount and Kmart would pay one-third. But the settlement in principle email drafted by Target's counsel doesn't mention this, nor does the final agreement. So I don't understand why, if it's such an important term, it was not included in either of these documents. And then if I want to go bigger context, how should we interpret Target's representation in the email setting forth the settlement terms that Target and Kmart would make payments, quote, in amounts to be determined by them, unquote? What, if anything, would have stopped the companies from agreeing, for example, that Kmart would pay the bulk of the settlement and the amount? So it's like we got all of this, but then none of it makes it into the agreement. And I got three lawyers here.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't draft the agreement, and I should have. And I think one fact that's undisputed is I requested two agreements from the outset. That's part of what Judge Sammartino relied on as one of, I think, six pieces of extrinsic evidence. If she goes beyond the written agreement itself, the fact that
hurts you instead of helping you. I mean, if you say, no, I insist, we're Target, we're only going to pay two-thirds, we're not going to pay the whole thing. But then it doesn't make it into the agreement. That means that it cuts against your side. It means you wanted it, but you didn't get it.
I think I got it, Your Honor, with the language saying that they acknowledge and agree that we're paying. Some's coming from Target, some's coming from Kmart.
It would have been easy enough to write in that X dollars will come from Target and Y dollars will come from Kmart. People write in how much they're going to pay when they're limiting how much they're going to pay.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor, but I think the requirement that the contract acknowledge that they understand that each one of us has a portion is enough to rebut the weak presumption. In fact,
okay, but what if we don't agree with you? And I'm saying this hypothetically that the settlement agreement doesn't impose joint liability, but also believe that the amount of Target's liability in the agreement was uncertain. What do we do? Do we just say the contract's void? What do we do?
I think because that was never argued before the district court and it was never requested and it was not requested by Eclipse or addressed by Eclipse in its opening brief before this court, I believe that that remedy is not available.
But if it were available, counsel, I guess you'd get your money back, right?
Well, and that's the next point, Judge Higginson, which is that in order for there to be a rescission, everyone has to be put back in their original positions. So the money has to be returned. I don't even know if it's possible at this point because Kmart has gone bankrupt and is now not party to this anymore. But certainly,
I don't even see why it's an issue. I don't see why there'd be any rescission. I mean, it's pretty common in personal injury cases involving multiple parties for the defendants to agree to pay the plaintiff the total settlement sum, and it's none of plaintiff's business how the defendants agree to divide it up among themselves. It's the defendant's business. They're dividing it up. And if they want the plaintiff to only hold this defendant for this much and that defendant for that much, they say so. Otherwise, the plaintiff doesn't have to sign a release till he gets all his money. And as for who winds up paying the money, the defendants can fight among themselves. That's how it always works, and every lawyer knows it. And if you're going to make it the plaintiff's problem to hold a particular defendant instead of the defendant's problem to hold each other, you say so in the deal. I don't see anything wrong with a deal that says the two of us are going to pay you this much money, and it's none of your business how much one defendant pays and how much the other defendant pays. I just don't see why it'd rescind. I don't see the problem. I don't see the ambiguity. I'm just missing what the problem is, let alone the solution.
Several things, Your Honor. You hit one thing on the head, which is this is not a personal injury case. And the 1659 and 1660 are specific to contract situations as opposed to injury situations where...
Yeah, and they're worse for you than it would be in a personal injury case.
But you have to also look, Your Honor, at the context of what this settlement agreement is covering. It's covering how to resolve a lawsuit where we had completely separate and several obligations. The only reason that they're in the lawsuit together is because it was common counsel. The only reason they're... I'm sorry?
No, I was wondering why you were in there at all. That was it, common counsel?
That's it. And it was separate plaintiffs, never co-defendants. And talking about joint and several liability, when you look at the complaint against, it was at this point, it was against Target, Kmart, and Toys R Us was also in the case. Okay, Toys R Us went bankrupt. If hoping I can find it, if you look at the way they pled the complaint against us, they go out of their way at, it's at SER, that's the supplemental record at 66. When they get to start delineating the dollars, which all come out to one-third, two-third, when they get to a line item where both Toys R Us and Kmart, I'm sorry, Toys R Us and Target were co-defendants, they specify joint and several liability in their prayer. But for every other element of damage, it's only several. It's an amount against Target and it's an amount against Kmart. There's no suggestion in the underlying litigation of any joint and several liability. Those are the circumstances that lead to the settlement agreement here.
Have you spent more on attorney's fees than $140,000?
I'm resisting paying the $140,000?
Yes.
No.
It's too bad there wasn't a hearing below, because do you agree that the district court may have been wrong when it said that all parties agree to the two-thirds, one-third divisibility?
Oh, Your Honor, I think that's the one thing Judge Sammartino said she acknowledged there wasn't agreement on. But what she did say is there's agreement that the settlement amount was based on the invoices. That's an admission by Ms. Hamilton, even in her...
But shouldn't Judge Sammartino have had a hearing on that? It was disputed.
That wasn't part of her finding. It wasn't part of the extrinsic evidence she relied on. She specifically said, if I remember correctly, that even if... we take it as true that the parties didn't discuss one-third, two-third expressly. What she found compelling was the underlying litigation came out that way. Then she proceeded to identify six other things she found compelling in the extrinsic evidence to overcome the presumption, including the fact that, for instance, she looked at my June 28 email that where I, right out of the box, before Mr. Lobin was even a party to this, because he was resisting, first thing I said is, I'll agree to one settlement agreement, but I need it to be clear that Kmart and Target are paying separately. That's what resulted in the language at the end of paragraph 3.
It's a lot like legislative intent. Then we look at the words that are finally there. It's like there's a lot of things people want that don't end up in a contract. So
I think this one did end up in the contract because it says...
I don't understand something there. What you've just explained to us makes it very clear that you wanted a limitation so that Target wouldn't be stuck with more than two-thirds. But it's not there in the contract. So if you want something and you make it explicit that you want it, and then it's not written into the contract, why doesn't that cut against your side? I mean, what you're saying is, it's fair, we should only pay two-thirds. I made it very clear to the other side, we only wanted to pay two-thirds, we were only willing to pay two-thirds, and then you signed a deal that doesn't say that. It seems to me that makes it worse for your argument instead of better, because we know that that possibility was put on the table by you, and you didn't get it in writing.
Well, we also have the other side claiming that they wanted to have joint and several liability. They were abundantly aware of the presumption. They didn't include it, and they actually admit in their opening brief at 21 and 22 that they intentionally stayed quiet on it because they were relying on then the wrong presumption, which is a stronger presumption, and they figured that would kick in, and they didn't want to raise it because they knew we'd never agree to it. So with that, I would also say that there's a statute in California that says, it's Civil Code 1654. In cases of uncertainty, the language of a contract should be interpreted most strongly, against the party who caused the uncertainty to exist. Now, I know, Judge Kleinfeld, you're going to say, well, you didn't put it in the agreement. I'm not talking about the language. I'm talking about sitting on your rights. They expressly state that they also admit for the first time in their opening brief, new argument. They admit that the agreement does not call for joint liability. Instead, they're saying we were relying on our
presumption. But they know perfectly well the statute says it's joint and several unless it's proven otherwise, unless something overcomes that presumption. Unless so all they have to do is sit on their hands. The
okay.
notion of sitting on
your
rights.
Hold on one sec. You're over time, but let me find out if my colleagues have questions.
Nope.
I'm okay.
Okay. Then we've taken you over time and your time's up. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And then you have 3 minutes and 14 seconds, Mr. O'Connor, for your rebuttal. Thank you. Oh, you got to put your mic on.
There we are. Thank you, Honor. Make one thing very clear. I never took the position that this contract should be void. We took the position that it should never be voided. And we said was that, and I addressed this, I think Judge Higginson asked about this, on page 7, footnote 1, I said, neither the court nor Target took the position that Target and Kmart had the right to bind plaintiff with Target and Kmart's subsequent determination as to their respective contributions. Such a position would void the contract ab initio because there would be no established liability as of the signing of the contract.
Are you reading from the principle or the reply brief?
I'm sorry?
Are you reading that new argument from the principle brief?
Yes. From the original brief, page 7, footnote 1.
Okay, so if we see ambiguity and the amount isn't clarified, your position is you owe them back the money?
No, my position is that if you took that position, that neither one of them owes any given amount. In other words, each one can say, I owe 10%, I owe 10%, and you're stuck with it. That means we have no recourse. That would be an invalid contract. So they can't take that position without voiding the contract. And if the court went along with that interpretation, the court would be voiding a contract, which should not be voided because it's a joint and several contract.
Well, it doesn't say joint and several. I'm curious about what Mr. Lechinger said about there were other parties that were involved in their contracts said joint and several, and this one doesn't. Is that true?
I don't know what he's talking about. With regard to this particular case, this is the only
one. Well, he was talking about Toys R Us, and I think he mentioned someone else. Were there other parties that were involved in this initially?
I don't believe so. Mr. Lobin can answer that because he represented all these parties. I don't know. I just represented them in terms of the settlement. Mr. Lobin could answer that if the court would allow him.
Well, I don't know. Does anyone else do either of my colleagues, are they curious about that? I don't like to make it, no. I mean, I don't like to make it like, okay, let everyone raise your hands if you want to talk. I try to have a little order here, but
I guess I'm still on the earlier point. I don't need to hear from Mr. Lobin, but I'm happy if either of you two do. What's your best case that the district court added an additional term with the 2/3, 1/3 cap?
Simple. There's nothing in this.
I'm asking your best case, California law case.
Oh, yeah. It's the, I'm sorry. I have to pull these cases out, but it was the, give me 1 second. I'll pull up my brief.
Oh, if it's in the brief, I've got it then. That's fine. Your time's almost up.
You have them in the brief. In the opening brief, they're all in there. If there's nothing else, I thank you.
All right, you're at zero. Okay, thank you both for your arguments. And this matter will stand submitted. And I believe that... what happened here? Okay, the court's in recess for the week. If the judges stay on, we'll be removed to the roving room. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
All parties having business with the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit will now depart. from this court. For this court stands adjourned.